Open your Bibles, please, to Ruth chapter 3, verse 10. So far in the book of Ruth, we have been introduced to three main characters. We've been introduced to Naomi and to Ruth and to Boaz. And we've seen that despite their flaws, each one of them ultimately trusts in God's covenant love for them. Each one of them has taken refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. They've each said to God, I will find my strength in the shadow of your wings. They've each put their trust in him, and they believe he has committed himself to them. They believe he's set his heart towards them to love them in a loyal way, the way a husband commits himself to a wife, to love her with a unique, sacrificial, special kind of love that goes beyond how he treats everyone else, or it better go beyond how he treats everyone else. A kind of love that is willing to lay its life down. And we said the way we know these characters really trust God and really trust his love for them is because they're willing to act like it in ways that involve risk. It's what we said last time. You know, as a married man, there are things I am able to risk because of the trust I have in my wife's covenant love for me. I can risk not combing my hair in the morning and be sure she'll hardly notice, partly because I have less hair. I can risk using her toothpaste and be sure she'll only be mad a little while. I can risk disagreement and be sure it's not a deal breaker in our marriage. I can risk admitting when I'm wrong and be sure she won't rub it in my face, at least not too much. I can risk letting her see my faults and be sure she won't reject me. I can risk failure and be sure she won't think less of me when I do fail. I can risk self-sacrifice and be sure I'm not the only one sacrificing. There are all sorts of things I'm able or willing to risk if I really trust the loyal love of my wife. And in a similar way, there are all sorts of things I will be increasingly able or willing to risk if I really trust the loyal love of God for me as well. If being under God's covenant love means the promise of refuge and safety, forgiveness and acceptance, provision and blessing and hope and rest both now and forever, then those who trust in him will also be able and willing to risk things they normally wouldn't. Like being real with God about their faults. If you trust his love for you, you'll be able to be real with God about your faults. Like admitting when you're wrong, like sacrificing personal preferences, like surrendering comfort and convenience, even safety, for the sake of his glory. Why? Why would we be willing to risk that? Well, because the people who love God and know God know he's in control, and that for the sake of his glory, he is unswervingly committed to defending them and ensuring their ultimate good, even at great personal cost to himself. And so those who trust in God's loyal covenant love are willing to take risk. That once again, is the big idea or theme of our text today. And there were five risks from our text that we have been looking at. I think we only got through the first two last time. First, we saw that such trust risks submitting to earthly authorities. God may not have revealed all the details when it came to his plan for Ruth and Naomi's lives, but they know the things that God has revealed in their lives, and so they try to be faithful in those little things. You know, when you can't see very far ahead, go as far as you can see. And so, for instance, Naomi knows the provisions God has put in place in his law to help widows. And Ruth knows the laws God has put in place to honor father and mother. And so while Naomi orchestrates this plan to take care of them, Ruth submits to her as a God-given authority in her life and acts according to what she said. All that you say, I will do, she says to Naomi. Because, we said, Ruth trusts her mother-in-law's desire to do what's best for her. But more importantly, I think, Ruth submits to her mother-in-law's plan because she trusts in her mother-in-law's God. Yahweh is the one who commands us to submit to those who are in authority over us because he is the one who put them in authority over us in the first place. In other words, obeying earthly authorities is a way of obeying God. Ruth told Naomi, "All that you have told me I will do," writes Pastor Bill Giovanetti. And we should be telling God day after day, "All that you have told me, I will do." No matter the risk, because your, he says this, because we should be telling God that no matter the risk, because your life, he says, is immeasurably better off with what God orchestrates than with what you orchestrate. Amen. And so Ruth has gone down to the threshing floor in obedience, in submission to Naomi, and waited until Boaz has eaten, fallen asleep, and then she's crept up to him in the darkness and uncovered his feet and laid down, all part of this really elaborate plan to propose marriage. Part of it comes from a known custom, we said, and part of it seems to be custom made as a response to something Boaz has already said. Still, it kind of sounds like a crazy plan. But Ruth risks because Ruth trusts God. She can't see very far ahead, but she goes as far as she can see. And in this case, that means submitting to the earthly authorities God has put in her life. And it's true that sometimes the risk of submitting to earthly authorities isn't quite as easy as this. What I mean is sometimes the risk of submitting to earthly authorities will feel greater than at other times. For instance, we don't always have the comfort of knowing that such authority really has our best interest at heart. Still, unless we can show how submitting to such an authority is forcing us to break God's law, we must obey them. The comfort is knowing that even when we're not sure that we can trust one of those authorities, whether a teacher or a boss or a governor or a president, we can always trust that the God who rules over them and who is in control of history knows our heart and has our best interest at heart. And so first, Ruth's trust risks submitting to earthly authorities. Second, last time we saw that such trust also risks misunderstanding, right? History and circumstance, we said, make what Ruth is doing extremely likely to be misunderstood. I mean, if she's caught down there, it would be bad news. We talked about how Ruth being a Moabite woman and how every Israelite knew that both the start of the Moabite nation as well as a key historical interaction with Moabite women in Israel's past, they've been stained by the same stigma of sexual immorality. We also talked about how the dark, isolated location of this threshing floor had a known reputation as a site where sexual immorality took place. Finally, we talked about how even some of the actions Ruth is taking at the threshing floor as part of this plan could be easily misunderstood and misinterpreted as suggestive or inappropriate by someone catching the two of them together there. You know, how they could even be misinterpreted, we said, by Boaz, right? In a way that might make him reject Ruth instead of receiving her. We said lifting up the corner or the wing of Boaz's robe in a way that exposed his feet was meant to point to the first step of a custom where a man spread part of his robe over a woman as a symbol or a signal of claiming her in marriage. It was a signal or a metaphor for protection or covenant commitment. And so by lifting his robe and laying down near his feet, Ruth was essentially suggesting what she wanted him to do for her. It was a proposal of sorts. She wanted for him, when he woke up because his feet were cold, to not just cover his feet again, but to also cover her. She wanted him to recognize her appeal to this custom and symbolically claim her as his bride. We said that Ruth and Naomi may also have made use of this custom in response to something Boaz said to Ruth earlier in the story, back in chapter 2, just in case what he said to her was his way of kind of shyly suggesting his openness to marriage. In chapter 2, Ruth had asked why Boaz was, why are you showing me so much favor, she says to him, by giving me all these special gleaning privileges. And after saying it was because of how she treated Naomi, Boaz went on to say this: a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And we said there were two things that Boaz could have meant there. Maybe both. He could have just been drawing attention to the fact that by clinging to Naomi and by clinging to Naomi's God, Ruth had also come under the covering of God's protection and his loyal covenant love. And that's certainly true. That has happened. But it's also possible he was saying that Ruth had taken refuge under the wings of God by coming there to his field. That he was saying, that was no accident. In other words, as John Piper points out, it's possible Boaz was sending a subtle signal of his own. I'm willing to be the permanent, concrete way that God provides for you and protects you. And so Ruth, showing up at the threshing floor and pulling back the wing or the hem of Boaz's robe, would have sent a sort of double signal, both a general one and a specific one. Generally, it signaled, I'm ready to be protected and provided for by a husband. And specifically, it signaled, yes, I want you to be that permanent, concrete way God protects me and provides for me. But what else might Boaz have thought if he had woken up and found part of his robe, thrown back by this Moabite woman lying at his feet in this dark, isolated place? Well, we said he might have thought the worst. He might have thought that she was making immoral advances towards him, at which point he could have rejected her as being a sinful woman, just like her ancestors, or at which point, worst case scenario, he could have taken advantage of her in a way she didn't intend. But because what's at stake is so great, and because Ruth trusts that God is in control and unswervingly committed to her good, she risks misunderstanding. And we said that we too are going to risk misunderstanding if we really trust God the way Ruth does. We're going to risk misunderstanding too. Since what's at stake is so great, the salvation of souls, we'll be willing to risk people thinking we're, simple and quaint because we believe in the God of the Bible. We should be willing to risk that. We should be willing to risk people thinking we're backwards and fundamentalists when we tell them we believe that everything the Bible says is true and trustworthy, even today. We should be willing to risk that. We even will be willing to risk people thinking that by the world's standards, we're immoral, that we are hateful, that we are hurtful, that we're bigots because we refuse to affirm popular sin. Because we continue to warn that the Bible says those sins will destroy people, not help them. It will destroy them and send them to hell unless they turn from them to follow Jesus. We'll risk misunderstanding if we really trust the Lord. And so first, trust in God's love for us risks submitting to earthly authorities. And then second, trust in God's love for us also risks misunderstanding. But the good news we ended with last time, if you remember, was that Boaz wakes up, and lo and behold, there's no misunderstanding. He instantly recognizes the meaning of the actions and the words of Ruth. Spread your wings over your servant, she says, for you are a redeemer. She means he's a relative who's not only able to give her refuge in marriage, but can also give the name of her late husband, Mahlon, a future, can even do more for the family if they have children together. And Boaz gets it. He totally understands the message. So that instead of rejecting her, he receives her. He welcomes her, even calls down a blessing on her. Which brings us now to the third risk in our text, which is that such trust in God's love for us also risks putting others first. Look with me now at verses 10 and 11. And he, Boaz, said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. The expression gone after or to go after, he says, you have not gone after young men. That phrase is connected in the Old Testament generally with a person chasing after sex. Is what it generally means. Leon Morris says it describes the efforts of a person, or the efforts a person makes to establish sexual relations with another. But it doesn't always mean that. It doesn't automatically refer to immoral efforts. It's likely just a way of saying Ruth hasn't made any efforts to seek out a choice young man for the purpose of marriage, the context in which such relations naturally take place. No, says Boaz, you know, you've neither gone after poor young men nor rich young men. I think the reasons for going after a rich young man seem pretty obvious, but what about reasons for going after a poor young man? I think the implication is that the only reason someone goes after a young man who's poor is because of love, because of attraction. And so it's another way of saying Ruth hasn't chased after love or money. You've not thought of yourself, Boaz is saying, either by going after a young man because of attraction or by going after a young man because of his bank account. And what this tells us is that Ruth was apparently free to do that. Boaz speaks of it like she was free to really have her pick of any of the town's eligible bachelors. In fact, many believe this is why he, if you remember, he kept insisting that she follow after his young men in the fields. He was genuinely, unselfishly concerned for her to find rest and refuge in a husband of her own age. But here he says she hasn't done that. She's gone after him, who is old enough, by comparison, to call her my daughter twice right there. And so I used to think, you know, when I was reading this story, I used to think when Boaz praised Ruth here, that it was because she was showing such great kindness to him, you know, the old guy. I thought he was saying it was kind of her to have pity on an older man like him. I thought he was blessing her for being willing to love him. For putting him before her own desires. But that's not really what he's saying, and I don't want us to miss that. Boaz is praising Ruth for showing kindness, for showing loyal love towards Naomi. That's what he's praising her for. He's blessing her for once again putting the good of her mother-in-law first. He's thanking her for choosing to follow the custom of redemption for Naomi's sake. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, he says, reminding us that putting others first is sort of a pattern in Ruth's life. Except that this act of love, he says, is greater than the first. And by greater than is meant better than, more glorious than, more magnificent than. Boaz is saying, Ruth has even more gloriously, even more magnificently reflected Yahweh's loyal love towards Naomi in this choice to marry him than she reflected Yahweh's loyal love towards Naomi back in chapter 1 when she chose to abandon her past rather than abandon her mother-in-law. Yes, in both cases, she's put the needs of Naomi first in ways that remind us of the sacrificial love of Jesus for his people. In both places, Ruth has considered her own happiness sort of secondary for the sake of another. But Boaz singles out this second act of loyal love as being even greater, he says, even better, even more glorious. Why? Why? In the words of R. Hubbard Jr., he's saying, this time, Ruth, you've outdone yourself. Why? Why does he say that? I think it's because instead of just putting an end to Naomi's string of losses in the past by going with her to Bethlehem, Ruth is now attempting to add to her a string of blessings that will go on into the future. She's not just stopping the bleeding, you know, so Naomi can heal. She's also now adding strength to strength so Naomi can hope, so Naomi can flourish. Instead of just stopping a decline, she's acting to reverse the decline, because by going along with this plan and choosing to follow the custom of redemption, Ruth opens up the possibility of an heir for her late husband and for Naomi. In other words, her actions can literally reverse the fortunes of and restore the future for an entire family line. I think that is why Boaz says she's outdone herself. And Ruth can risk doing all this. She can risk this because her heart has been so comforted and filled up by Yahweh's loyal love for her. She's been so satisfied in him, as a result, he is more glorified in her. The product of her satisfaction in him is that she's done nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility has counted others more significant than herself. She knows she's not really entitled to get anything, hardly at all, from Israel's people or Israel's God. And yet, Yahweh has treated her with much more significance than she deserves. In fact, he's overwhelmed her with special favor. And so, from a place of gratitude and for the joy set before her because she trusts she can't outgive Yahweh, she is treating people the way she's been treated, looking not only to her own interests, but also to the interests of others. She did not simply let her own personal inclinations rule her, writes Leon Morris. And what that pattern of behavior has won for Ruth is a reputation. And now, my daughter, do not fear, says Boaz. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. What an asset that is for Ruth. Proverbs 22:1 says, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. Boaz says, all my fellow townsmen, and that's most literally translated, all the gate of my people. It's kind of a strange idiom. It's a reference to all the people who have to pass through Bethlehem's gate to get into the town, who gather, all the people who gather there at the gate market to buy and sell goods, all the people who come there to the elders at the gate to argue and settle legal matters. In other words, it was another way of saying, everyone in the whole town, they all know you're a worthy woman. That phrase, woman of worth, or woman of strength, or virtuous woman, it can also be translated excellent wife. And it's most famously translated that way in Proverbs 31, verse 10. An excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. Now, that last chapter in Proverbs goes on to list the desirable character traits of such a woman, traits like strength, trustworthiness, industry, shrewdness, generosity toward the needy, and efficiency. You know, in our Bibles, if you were to open up to Proverbs, the book that comes after Proverbs in our Bible is Ecclesiastes, but what's interesting is that so many people in history have connected the ideals of that last chapter of Proverbs to the character of Ruth, that there have actually been some canonical traditions that purposely placed the book of Ruth right after the book of Proverbs. It's really interesting because, as Daniel Block puts it, in some circles, Ruth was considered the supreme illustration of feminine nobility. And so, you know, you would have had the book of Proverbs ending with chapter 31 and this portrait of an ideal woman or wife, and then you jump immediately into Ruth's story as if to illustrate it. And it makes sense why someone would do that, doesn't it? You can see why. Everyone can. Which is why Boaz is essentially saying, as another commentator put it, the whole town knows you're a bride worth winning. But I want to point out here that I think this is important. There's a big difference between other people thinking you're virtuous and you thinking you're virtuous. It's a big gap between those two things. A person who thinks too highly of themselves, who thinks there's nothing they need to change, who thinks they don't need any help from God, they're good enough already, you know, is not going to treat people around them the way Ruth does here. And neither is such a person going to have this reputation that Ruth has. And that's because a person who thinks they're doing pretty good already is going to be thinking about themselves, not others. The only time they're going to be thinking about others is when they're comparing themselves to others or when they're expecting praise from others. A person like that is not looking to be forgiven of anything or looking to give away anything. Instead, Jesus says, it's the one who's been forgiven much who loves much. It's a person who knows he doesn't measure up. It's a person who knows she deserves much worse. It's a person who knows they've used up all their second chances. It's that kind of person who will, in the end, joyfully pour out their lives for others. And they'll do it. They'll do it because they've encountered the God who first poured out mercy and blessing on them instead of judgment. That's why they'll do it. They've encountered the God who confirms they don't measure up, but says he'll meet the measure for them. The God who confirms they deserve much worse, but says he'll take what they deserve for them. These people have met the God who confirms they've used up all their second chances with their very first sin, but says he'll become sin for them and give them in exchange his own righteousness. And our God has done all of this for us in Jesus Christ. Yahweh outdoes himself in showing us his loyal love. Because why? Well, because Jesus does more than just leave his heavenly home to tabernacle with us here on earth. He does more than that. He does more than just forsake the glory he had rights to in order to come to us veiled in the humility of humanity. He does more for us than just come to staunch the bleeding, more than just come to cut our losses by being cut down in our place on a cross. Yahweh outdoes himself. He does better than, more glorious than, more magnificently than before, by also coming with a string of blessings that add strength to strength to those he sacrificed for and which go on into the future. His actions literally reverse the fortunes of and restore the future of an entire family line, the line of Adam. He comes and he grants us forgiveness and then adds to it the strength of his own righteousness. God provides the righteous heir we need in himself, a baby born in Bethlehem, so that in him we too might become the righteousness of God, so that we too might be saved from extinction and remain connected to covenant blessings by being joined to a new family tree. And though all of this great plan of God it's still unfolding in the time of Ruth, it includes the little plan Ruth and Naomi have at this threshing floor. God gathers this foreign woman beneath his wings, and he folds her choices into his providential purposes, and he pours out his favor and blessing and loyal love on her who should have been an enemy, all for his good, his glory, and for her good. And she knows it. She knows it. Ruth knows what she deserves as an outsider, and she knows what she's been given instead by God. She knows the disparity. Pastor Bill over at Pathway calls it the nobody owes me principle, and she gets it. He says this about that principle. This principle simply believes that any goodness that comes my way is a gift far better than I deserve. That's the nobody owes me principle. Bill goes on to emphasize this by saying, the only thing that any human being is owed is eternal condemnation in the lake of fire. Anything cooler than that is grace, he says. And Ruth gets that. Ruth understands that. And Ruth's grateful trust in response is so great that she can risk submission, she can risk misunderstanding, she can even risk putting the needs of others first. Her response of grateful trust is so great that it shines out of these pages, and it shines so brightly, it's not just Boaz who can see it, the whole town can see it too, and so can we. Instead of her age, instead of her economic status, instead of her race, and instead of her past, it is God's work in her life that has become the most important and the most valuable thing about her. And so it is with all God's people. We are all bound together by the need and by the results of redemption. And as we learn to trust God more and more, like Ruth and Naomi and Boaz do, we'll also be bound together by a common willingness to take certain risks. Which brings us now to the fourth risk in our text, which is that a trust in God's love for us also risks losing good things for the sake of the best. At this point, Boaz seems to have said yes to Ruth's proposal. I will do for you all that you ask, he said to her. That not only refers to the marriage proposal, but also implies all that redemption for Naomi's family includes. And so I imagine Ruth having just let out, you know, a huge sigh of relief. This could have gone so badly, and it seems like it's going well. And so I picture having just let out this huge sigh of relief when she hears Boaz now say this in the next breath. Look with me now at verses 12 and the first part of 13. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, Boaz says, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good. Let him do it. Now, to understand why this is such a bombshell that just got dropped on Ruth's party, let's briefly review the redeemer laws. A redeemer or a goel was a near male relative who had certain duties towards the clan or the extended family. And there are two duties of a redeemer in particular that apply most specifically to this situation. The first, we've talked about this a little already, was the responsibility, if financially able, to buy back the property of a relative so that the family plot and its benefits wouldn't be lost to that family or lost to the tribe. And then the second main duty of a redeemer that applies to this situation has to do with the leveret laws. We said the word leveret comes from the Latin word for brother-in-law or husband's brother. And that's because in Deuteronomy chapter 25, the Israelites are given this sort of strange, unusual law that basically said if a man died without an heir, whether daughters or sons, if he didn't have any kids, then his nearest male relative, ideally, best case scenario, his brother, was to act as a redeemer by marrying his widow. In that scenario, the duty of a redeemer was to protect his brother's widow, to provide for her, and ultimately, the most important part was to produce an heir for his dead brother. It was basically another way to maintain the property rights of the deceased man's family line and maintain the territorial holdings of his tribe. It was a way to make sure that man and his name and his family, in this case, Naomi and Ruth, and the first child born to Ruth, could be provided for and would not lose out or be left out of the benefits of being part of the covenant community. It was sort of a biblical social security system. And so, with all that in mind, realize that Naomi and Ruth have built their whole plan around Boaz being that redeemer for their family. Realize that in their minds, he's the nearest male relative who can rescue them, or at least the one they're hoping for. Realize that there's a very real possibility here that Ruth actually does have feelings for Boaz and is just beginning to hear wedding bells in the distance. She's planning her wedding. She's picturing her dress. Put all that together, and you get a sense, you know, for how these words must have hit Ruth when she heard them. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, Boaz says. Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Yes, Ruth, I am a relative of your husband's family who can marry you and who can redeem you. But I'm not the closest relative. Yes, Ruth, I'm a kinsman redeemer, but I'm not the kinsman redeemer. I'm not. Unfortunately, I'm not the next in line to marry you. Now, there's a couple important things I think this tells us about Boaz. I think it tells us first that, that he must have already been thinking about the possibility of this scenario, however unlikely. I think it tells us he's been thinking about Ruth, and he's been thinking about her situation already, so much so that he has gone through the trouble of doing a little research and even gaming out what might happen in the infinitely small off chance that she actually approached him. And so he already knows, in the unlikely event that Ruth decides not to go after one of the eligible bachelors her own age in Bethlehem, he already knows she's going to be left with only two options in that case. Either him or one other male relative in town who seems to have been overlooked. But second, I think what this tells us about Boaz is that he knows God's law and he cares about it. That says a lot about him because he knows about this other relative and he knows that technically this other relative is ahead of him in the accepted next of kin line to redeem Ruth. That accepted order probably followed the same pattern as the one laid out in Leviticus 25 for the order of relatives responsible to redeem a family member from slavery. The duty fell first to a brother, and then to an uncle, and then to a cousin or any blood relative in the clan after that. And the bottom line is that this other man is further up that list in relation to Elimelech and Mahlon than Boaz is. This is why I think there's never a mention, if you look at the text, there's never a mention of Boaz, you know, symbolically completing the custom that was started by Ruth, you know, and covering her with the part of his robe that she's pulled back here at the threshing floor. Why hasn't he done that? I think it's because, as one commentator puts it, Boaz is forced by his own integrity to report that he is not the kinsman redeemer. And so he doesn't have the right to do that yet. Making the engagement official, even symbolically, has to wait. And so, remain tonight, Boaz says, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good. Let him do it. I want you to think about what Boaz is saying here. He's saying he is willing to lose Ruth to this other man in order to do what is just and right. This is no small thing. As good a thing as marriage to Ruth would be, the integrity of Boaz and his trust in God's loyal love gives him the moral courage to risk losing the good thing for the sake of the best thing, which is acting in obedience to God. He too has a heart like Jesus, which prays, "I delight to do your will, O my God." Friends, there are many good things waiting for you in this world, even in this fallen world. But the constant test of integrity and trust in God in this life is going to be a willingness to lose what is good for the sake of what is best. Or to put it another way, the constant test of integrity and trust in God in this life will be you doing your best as you rely on God to choose the better or best thing whenever possible over the good thing. Security and comfort are good things. We all agree about that? Security and comfort, good things. But God rebukes the Israelites through Moses and Aaron when they want to go back to Egypt, where they perceive those things are, instead of choosing the best thing, which is following God's plan to go into the promised land. Offering sacrifices to God is presented all throughout the Old Testament as a good thing. But God rebukes King Saul through Samuel for his planned sacrifices and tells him, what? It would have been a better thing. It would have been the best thing if he'd just been obedient to the specific command God gave him. Hospitality and service, those are good things. Those are good things. But Jesus gently rebukes Martha for choosing busy work over the better or best thing, which is communion with him, seeking his presence, prioritizing his word. Self-preservation is a good thing. It's a natural instinct that God has given us. We should be thankful for that. But Jesus gently rebukes Peter, predicting he'll avoid persecution by denying him instead of choosing the better or the best thing, which would have been loyal devotion to Jesus, acknowledging him boldly before men. And there are plenty of other good things that we'll be challenged to lose for the sake of the better or the best things too? Are you willing to lose friendships, which are good things, for the sake of speaking the truth in love, which is better? Are you willing to lose sleep, which is a very good thing, for the sake of communion with Jesus, seeking his presence, prioritizing his words, all better things? Are you willing to lose comfort and safety, both good things, for the sake of telling someone about their need for Jesus, which is far better? Are you willing to lose freedom, which is a very good thing? Are you willing to lose freedom for the sake of committing yourself to serve someone else, which is a better thing? Are you willing to lose time and income and a nice unscheduled morning, which are good things, for the sake of gathering with God's people on a Sunday for worship, which is a better thing? A person who trusts God's loyal love will be increasingly able to risk losing good things for the sake of the best, because he or she is slowly learning through many failures and through many forgivings that God is in control, and that for the sake of his glory, he is unswervingly committed to defending them and ensuring their ultimate good, even at great personal cost to himself. And if ever you doubt that, just remember that he too has willingly lost his own son for the sake of what he deemed the better or the best thing, bringing many other sons and daughters to glory. Well, Boaz has just dropped a bombshell on Ruth, so that even 3,000 years removed from that moment, and even straining to see through the inky darkness there at that threshing floor, I feel like we can still make out a look of fleeting fear on Ruth's face. I don't think that's far-fetched, which brings us at last to the fifth and final risk in our text. First, we saw that trust in God's love for us risks submitting to earthly authorities. Second, trust in God's love for us risks misunderstanding. Third, trust in God's love for us risks putting others first. Fourth, trust in God's love for us risks losing good things for the sake of the best. And now fifth, trust in God's love for us also risks leaving the results in God's hands. Remain tonight, Boaz has said. And in the morning, if he will redeem you, good. Let him do it. Look with me now at the second half of verse 13. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. There's something that's easy to miss here, I think, in all the drama, and it's the fact that one way or another, God has just confirmed through Boaz that Ruth will be redeemed. Did you notice that? She will be redeemed. Either he will redeem you, Boaz says, referring to this other guy, or I will redeem you, he says. Actually, he says it more forcefully than that. It's what's called an emphatic pronoun, like a repetition for emphasis. So it's really more like, I, myself, will redeem you. And then just to make sure she knows that he's extra serious, he leads into that emphatic pronoun by linking his promise to Yahweh's own existence in a formal oath. He'll do this as the Lord lives, he says. One commentator points out that by doing this, what Boaz has done is willingly subjected himself to divine punishment if he fails to keep his word. The point is, either way, Ruth, and by extension the family, will be redeemed. Refuge and rescue and rest have just been forcefully promised. The ultimate outcome has just been emphatically settled, you know, so that all that remains to be sorted out are the details. And so it is with us if we have gone to God in the darkness of despair and asked him to cover us and to cover our sin with the blood of his son. So it is with us if we have asked him for mercy, asked him to look not at our life, please, but at the righteous life of him who is our Redeemer. The end of that plea is always the same assurance that mercy and redemption are ours. Refuge and rescue and rest have been forcefully promised to you if you've gone to God in that way. The ultimate outcome of our lives has been emphatically settled if you have sought the mercy of God. We've been saved, we are being saved, and we will be saved. That much we can know with certainty. It's just all the details we're not sure about. But Ruth, I think, like you and I, she cares about the details. She cares about them, and so does Boaz. I think it matters to them both very, very much who she ends up marrying. That detail is important. And so I don't think we should picture them, you know, pasting on fake smiles and pretending they don't care what happens next. No, they do care. They very much care. It's just that there's something else they care about more. They both care more about yielding to the will of God. They both trust more in the loyal love of God. They both trust more in the loyal love of God for them to bring about the best outcomes, even in the details. They trust in that more than they trust in their own opinions or preferences or plans. They really are a good match. They both trust God in that way. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure they both also tell God exactly what they prefer. I think there's probably a whole lot of praying going on at this threshing floor. It's just that in the end, they both know their lives are immeasurably better off with what God orchestrates than what they can orchestrate. And people who know and trust that about God are willing to take risks. Risks like leaving the results in God's hands, even when it comes to the details. And so, righteous man that he is, writes R. Hubbard Jr., Boaz will settle things through proper means and leave the outcomes to God. And as for Ruth, woman of worth that she is, we'll see next week that she does exactly what Boaz says and lies down at his feet until the morning. And I want you to remember the context. She is lying down without closure in all the details. She's lying down without all the I's dotted, without all the T's crossed. Ruth literally does the most unproductive, the most vulnerable, the most helpless thing a human being can do. She lays down and does nothing. She possibly even sleeps, although I doubt it. Yes, there remain uncertainties. I'm sure it wasn't the best night's sleep of either of their lives. And yet the Bible constantly teaches that joy is the byproduct of trusting God. And so I have to believe that even if Boaz and Ruth were not happy about the situation, still, the joy of being understood and the joy of being seen and the joy of being chosen and the joy of being honored and blessed that night and the joy of a possible future together and most importantly, the joy of knowing that they're both pursuing God's will, I have to believe this joy is able to outweigh the worry. So that both of them might be able to say to God, even under these circumstances on that threshing floor, as their great-grandson would one day write, "You, God, have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety." Psalm 4, 7 and 8. Friends, do you trust the loyal love of God enough to risk laying down and letting go of outcomes, even to the point of details? Probably not. Probably you don't. And I don't either. If you're like me, there are probably still plenty of sleepless, restless nights with little trust. Joy comes in the morning. But God being your helper, the more you learn to trust in his loyal love for you, the more you will learn to leave outcomes and even details in his hands at the end of each day. So that you'll one day be able to say, along with Ruth and Boaz, "In peace, I will both lie down and sleep."